Pansifer's Podcast, a podcast on Rosicrucianism, Hermeticism, and the teachings of the Western esoteric tradition, where adepts, practitioners, researchers share their views.
Hello, friends and listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Pansifer's Podcast. Episode 3, it already is, of this new podcast, which is to be found on the Pansifer's webpage, pansifer.com, but also as it is also produced by me as a special treat on the Thoth Hermes podcast. It can also be found on the page of Thoth Hermes Podcast, thothhermes.com. But of course, it will be available on all outlets for podcasts, as well as on YouTube, both on the Pansifer's channel and on the Thoth Hermes channels. So you can find us wherever you want, and you can find me today with my guest, Travis Trinka, and we are going to speak about his new book, The Temple and the Vault. But not only, we talk about Rosicrucianism, about Masonry, about the history of ritual and, well, in a way, where it all comes from, discovered or hidden stories and timeless wisdom of Rosicrucianism and Freemasonry. And he did that in this very, very bright and dense book as well, The Temple and the Vault. Well, it's a great pleasure to have you here. And as you're used to when you listen to my shows also on Thoth Hermes, that we always play some music. And we always do that before the interview. We will do that as well in a short break we take in the middle of the interview and at the end, after the last piece. And I think we should delve directly into the first piece of music. This is today all about ritual in some way, right? And the music should also reflect that a bit. I have asked Travis for a piece of music he would like us to play, and he chose a piece by Debussy, the Pagodas by Claude Debussy on piano. And but that's not what you're going to hear about now, because Debussy wrote his music a little bit inspired, well, quite a lot inspired actually, by Indonesian gamelan music, which of course is also some kind of ritual music. And therefore, before we go into the interview, I will play for you some Indonesian gamelan music, traditional music from Indonesia. To be more precise, Sabilulun is the name of that traditional type of music we're going to hear. And I hope you'll enjoy it. It's very soft somehow, also percussion-y. And remember that piece that you're going to hear now, when later on in the break you will hear Debussy's Europeanized version. Oh no, maybe we should say he has just been influenced by those sounds for his piano piece Pagodas that we're going to hear in the interval. Right, so without further ado, let's listen to Indonesian gamelan music, Sabilulun. Enjoy. Thank you.
Here comes the interview.
It is with great pleasure that we are going far away from where I am, maybe not far away from where you, dear listeners, are. Maybe if you're in Australia, you're quite close to our guest here today. And my guest here is Travis Trinka. And welcome, Travis, to be here on the Pan Sofas podcast. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much, Rudolf. Lovely to be here.
Travis, you have recently, and that's the immediate reason why we meet you today, you have recently published, I think it's your first book, right?
That's correct, yes.
Right, The Temple and the Vault with Louis Lassonic. And I received that book and I find it very interesting. It's very dense. I think when we're going to talk about it and when I tell people it's hardly 200 pages, they will wonder how you were able to fit all that into those 200 pages, but it's quite amazing. And it talks mostly, please correct me if you see that differently, about initiatic myths and their outcome, so to speak, right?
Yes, that's right. So about all the stories that we use within initiatic traditions, we all seem to have a lot of stories that we use, and look, they might form the backbone of a ritual or a drama or sometimes a traditional history. But yes, the purpose of using these stories, why we use them, how they work, what makes a good story, what makes a bad story, and some samples of different stories from various traditions as well.
Exactly. So very interesting. Bobby, we're going into that into detail in a minute. But before we go into those stories, tell us about your story. Not the myth, not the Travis Trinka myth. That's for in about 200 years, but... about your story, what made you come to the point of writing such a book? You probably have lots of personal experience in the Western tradition, etc. So tell us about you and how that all happened.
Yeah, look, I had been planning on writing a book sometime down the track. It was never something I really wanted to do right now. But I suppose everything just aligned. I had just finished my MBA. I was working part time. I started taking down some notes, and one thing led to another. I really just couldn't stop writing. So I thought, well, this is it. This is the time. My family life and career life and Masonic life, everything was just there to say, all right, well, keep writing. So that's what I did. So it came out a few years earlier than what I expected it to do. But yeah, look, my background, first heard about the Western esoteric tradition, I suppose like many millennials, people my age, was through the work of Dan Brown through the Da Vinci Code. I was a teenager, read the Da Vinci Code, and I came across the Freemasons, and I thought, oh, this sounds pretty cool. I want to learn more about them. There wasn't a lot of information. I used to head down to, there was a lovely bookstore here in Melbourne, what still is here, it's just changed location, it's a Theosophical Society bookstore. And I'd head down there to try and find out some more information about the Freemasons, but very soon after I came across the Rosicrucians, and it was like a lock and key. It just opened something up. Well, I've got to learn more about the Rosicrucians. Back in the day, you couldn't really find much information. So again, it was back down to the TS bookstore, see what I could find. Found out there was a Rosicrucian group in my area. So promptly joined as soon as I was old enough, and was quite active in that group. That was AMOR. I was quite active in there for a number of years, taking on various roles and offices, both at Lodge and Grand Lodge level. By the time I had my second kid, I thought, well, or my first child, actually, I felt like I really needed to pursue that Freemasonry again. So I knew a couple of people that were able to propose me in. And that's mostly what occupies my time now is Freemasonry. I'm junior warden of North Melbourne Lodge number 41, involved in a couple of appendant bodies, but most notably the SRIA, Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, belong to a couple of colleges here, secretary at Demiurgus College number 3, chartered in 1886, which for Australia is quite old. It's European, it might not be that old, but for Australia, 1886, predates not only our Grand Lodge Victoria, but also...
It's quite old as well, because, I mean, they're not that much older in the UK, is it?
Well, that's right. Yeah, it was only number three on the register, which is, you know, a bit of an unusual question. Why did they choose to charter a Rosicrucian college in a colony on the other side of the world as opposed to local colleges? And it's not like we were the first of a bunch. It was another year, nearly 2 years before the fourth college was chartered. We were chartered by Woodman was a Supreme Magus, and Westcott was the Secretary General. But even then, that's a little bit of an oddity, because according to official SRAA history, Westcott wasn't actually Secretary General until the following year. It's a bit of an oddity why he was signing it at that point. I suppose it just shows his enthusiasm. You know, he was destined to be a founding member
of the Golden Dawn as well, of course. Westcott.
That's correct. Yes.
Right. Back to you. So, I would have almost said when you go to a Theosophical Society bookstore, you probably more easily end up Rosicrucian than Mason, in a way, with the books you will find, at least over here. But why did you say that when you got your kid and et cetera, it was time for Masonry again? I just recall you said that, and that kind of clicked here. I wanted to ask you why you're making that link.
Well, look, looking back and reflecting upon it, it really was the right time. I think if I had have joined Freemasonry as soon as I turned 18, I probably still wouldn't be a member now. I probably would have joined, expected something, become disillusioned and left, which unfortunately happens to a lot of Freemasons here in Australia, and I'm sure in other areas of the world as well. So really, it was the right time for me to join Freemasonry. I was able to see things with a bit more of an understanding after having been involved in initiatic societies for a while. But also I felt that just the way my life was at that time, it was time to stop focusing so much on psychic phenomena and all these sorts of things and focus on life. You know, I had I was married, had a house, good career, studying. I really wanted to be surrounded by people that were in a similar sort of position, I felt, and also wanted to be involved in an initiatic group where I could maintain my private life as number one. I had been involved in, as I said, in AMOR for quite some time, and I think at that point I was also getting a little bit disillusioned as well, so it was also time for a bit of a sea change.
But I think we'll come back to Amarok a little bit later, but there are interesting parallels in myself and also some other people I've interviewed here with, but you just said, but we'll come back to that in more detail maybe when we speak about Amarok, because that's also part of your book very, very prominently there. I was interested to understand why, as a 18-year-old, if I get you right, you were getting fascinated or attracted by Rosicrucianism. And let's not talk about Amarok as such, but Rosicrucianism in general. What was the attraction back then for you?
Yeah, I suppose it's not normally what many 18-year-olds are thinking about. Look, I suppose it really, it's these sorts of ideas, philosophical ideas, is just something that I've thought about as far back as I can remember, which is probably not unusual for many esotericists to have that sort of background. I didn't grow up in a religious household by any means. I was the youngest of four children. I was pretty much able to do whatever I want. We didn't have a religious house. I probably would have liked to have come from a religious household. I was always interested in spirituality and always interested in looking at books about cathedrals and churches and things like this, and it was always just sort of searching. By the time I got to my teenage years, it was something that I just read about all the time. It was something that I was really interested in. I was sort of surrounded in the periphery with I suppose tools and implements of the Western esoteric tradition. Like, my mother had friends that were self-proclaimed psychic readers and tarot readers. And so I always had things like tarot cards and runes and psychic readers right. and stuff all in my periphery. And all of that stuff just absolutely fascinated me. So it was something that was always just a bit of a personal interest.
But it's not something that you're... parents or your family brought you into it was your own search, basically.
That's right. That's right. And mm-hmm. there's some people that do come from a religious background and they find that they struggle to reconcile their mystical search with that religious background, where I was quite the opposite. In some ways, I would have liked to have had a foundation in some sort of religious background. But on the other hand, I'm also quite fortunate. I also don't have any of those hang-ups that some people might get from having a dodgy religious background as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I was asking you also about that 18-year-old Rosicrucian that you were or started to be, because I could imagine, and that brings us slowly towards the myths and the stories, that the Rosicrucian foundation myth has something which I find in a way very romantic to it. More than others, I mean, more than Masonic myths, for example, or others that we know and we're going to talk about. I don't know if that's also how you see it. Maybe that wasn't the thing that influenced you back then, but do you nowadays feel that, Rosicrucianism is also a bit, even though it's not at all German Romanticism by its epoch, but has some romantic aspects to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, part of the purpose of the book was to try and rekindle a bit of romance for some of these stories. And when it comes to these stories, to me, Rosicrucianism and the Rosicrucian story itself is probably the most important. There's Masonic commentators and authors like you've got Gould, Quincy, de Boulay, and they all say that Freemasonry probably wouldn't have been established if it wasn't for Rosicrucianism, because a lot of the pioneers of Freemasonry were sort of spurred on by Rosicrucian pursuits. That story is, it's interesting. Like the story that first appeared in The Farmer is, in some ways, it's quite simple. It's so simple that we often forget about it. A lot of people don't really pay much importance, even in Rosicrucian traditions. And yes, look, it is quite simple, but that first manifesto, or The Farmer, was directed towards the learned and heads of estates and whatnot as well. So it had a target audience, and it does seem to have hit that target audience, judging by all the responses and replies that followed. But I suppose just as a summary for those that might not be familiar with it, the story is about a young boy, Christian Rosenkreuz, although it doesn't say his name in the Farmer. He's only a young boy. He's living in an unknown monastery somewhere in Germany, and he goes on a pilgrimage to the Holy Sepulchre with a companion. But partway there, he hears about these wise men from some faraway land, and this really impresses him, because apparently these wise men, they knew all the secrets of nature. So he thinks, well, I don't really want to go to the Holy Sepulchre anymore. I want to find these wise men. So he seeks them out. He eventually finds them, and he's stopping in many places along the way and learning new things and getting older. These wise men entrust to him their holy book, which he translates, and he takes it back with him to Europe and says, well, I'm going to instruct all the religious leaders in Europe, and we'll help heal the world. But they weren't really willing to give up their power. They had the status quo. So he says, well, buggy, or I'm going to start my own secret society of Rosicrucians, and we'll preserve and perpetuate this wisdom behind the scenes in secret. And that's sort of how things continued on. The story itself is quite simple, but it is quite archetypal. And there's little hints to his journey. He starts off as a young boy. As he gets old, as he makes all these various stops, he gets older. By the time he arrives back in Europe, he's being referred to as Father Christian. You know, he's now a man. He's started his work as an adult. It does sort of mirror our own sort of journey and our own life's journey.
I would like to say here at that point that probably for many of us who are also seasoned Western esotericists, we'll call it like that, it would be good to reread Farmer, because I have made the experience, everybody talks about it, but hardly anyone really knows the in-depth content of it. And I don't know about you, but I, of course, that should probably be the case with all those great and important myths. But it more than others, I feel that the Fama and its story relates very, very much to the to our time as well. It's and not just in personal development. I mean, not just in the individual's development, but in the situation of the world and what it needs and et cetera, et cetera. It's something that's very archetypal and is true until the 21st century, or even more so.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, the story itself closes with a tomb of Christian Rosenkreutz being opened, which is sort of used as a sometimes by Rosicrucian traditions as a bit of a metaphor for an order being opening up or becoming active. You know, the tomb's opened, eventually it reaches its peak, it becomes a bit of a parody of itself, and it closes down, rinse and repeat. And I think if some of the themes that are being discussed in the Fama ever more so appealing to people today, it is exactly as you say. If you look outside your window and look at the world today, we're living in much the same environment. You know, the reason why the Fama had the effect it had was not just because of the elements of the story itself, but because of the way society was at the time as well.
Yeah.
And that conflict on religious, social, cultural levels that we were appearing then in Germany is exactly what's happening now, but perhaps even on a grander scale, on a worldwide scale. So yes, I think you're right. I think its importance is probably even more relevant today maybe not more relevant. I suppose it did contain some political and religious themes that were very particular to that time, but at least thematically, it is very relevant for today as well.
Absolutely. You just said something, I was going into that now, maybe we can expand a little bit on that. Of course, the question that arises when you have those archetypal myths, take this one, but others, they have all started to exist. They had been created in a way, if one can create the myths, but that's another question, at some point in history, when the situation, the sociological society and situations, etc., were of a certain kind, political, religious, etc. And then they have been used and applied over centuries, often more than centuries, even millennia, right? And don't you think it can or could and does maybe even easily happen that a myth as we see it today is mistaken because we do not understand the time when it was created? We cannot understand the time when it was created. Or is such a myth always out of time somehow? Or what makes the difference between those types of myths?
It's a very good question. And you're right, there are some themes in initiatic traditions that are simply timeless. If we look at the Egyptian mysteries, for instance, we know a little bit about what was happening in some places there, like in the Assyrian. There are some themes which are timeless. We might see some themes that were there then that reappearing in things like the Hiramic myth in Freemasonry. But there are also some things which have fallen by the wayside, and probably for good reason. You know, what makes some of these stories so relevant is how they are able to speak to us. And yes, while we might all have something common that exists within us that we share, we also come from different cultural backgrounds. We live in a very particular point in time. So, for instance, with the negative confessions in Egypt, some of them might still be relevant today. You know, don't steal, don't hurt people, these sorts of things. But some things just simply aren't relevant. Don't divert water, don't... things one about not stealing grain or stealing food from a baby. I suppose that might be still relevant in some areas, but some of these ideas...
If it's not grain, it's something else. Yeah.
Some of these things just aren't relevant to us anymore, which makes it challenging because we do have some initiatic traditions which are still living, and they've been existing for a very long time, and there's been no updates. And look, I am a bit conservative when it comes to the idea of updating traditions. I think it's something that should be done, if at all, should be done absolutely gradually and with great thought. But certainly we also have to consider that as time moves on, as the culture changes, we need to make sure that story can talk to the candidate. There's no point having a candidate walking into the room going through the ceremony and not understanding what's happening, you're only getting half of the story then. You need a good team, you need a good story, but you also need that candidate to understand what they're going through. It doesn't mean that they have to intellectually understand everything, that they have to remember everything. No, not at all. We witness these ceremonies dozens of times as we participate in them in future as witnesses and as officers. We still learn something new. But at least it still has to be relevant to the culture and the time. And certainly in the first part of the book, I tried to discuss that about what makes a good initiatic story. And part of that is its cultural relevance.
Uh-huh. Can you, sum up, we want people to also get that book and read it, but can you maybe sum up in a few moments, maybe a few sentences, what makes, in your point of view, a good initiatics story or a good myth? What's the key to make it a good story?
It's a bit of a tricky question because there's no one size fits all group for starters. So there's some people that join one group and it transforms their life. You know, it's really their initiatic home and it means something for them, but it might not be for everybody. But I suppose what makes one good is something that is able to bring the candidate to an understanding of something within themselves. And this is the whole idea of esotericism. And I know people like to talk about esoteric Freemasonry and they start talking about, you know, how the checkered carpet might relate to Hermeticism or how the rough and perfect ashlars might relate to the prima materia and philosopher's stone. But these are really just adding on new terms to existing ideas. That's not esoteric at all. What makes it esoteric is being able to bring that candidate to an understanding of something within themselves, you know, that there's something divine within themselves. And this is the whole purpose of the ritual drama itself. We don't just read the allegory, but we try to experience it. We try to play with colors and sounds and all the elements that are in the lodge room to try and bring the candidate to some awareness of something within themselves. So what would make a good myth is something that is able to speak to the candidate through their intellectual outer to help bring out something that's within themselves, help them recognize something divine within themselves. But yeah, I don't think there's any one-size-fits-all myth. I mean, certainly the Hieramic myth itself, I think, is fantastic, but certainly not for everybody and certainly not available to everybody either.
Yeah, and you said intellectual appeal, but probably also emotional at the same time, and it's the balance between the two that probably makes also the myth, but when you are a candidate, at least what it creates in you, you don't know. So how, I'm now speaking for those who listen here. I mean, the audience here is mostly a bit educated in the field, but there might also be others who are looking for something for themselves or maybe the right group or so. But you don't know those myths. I mean, you can read the myths, but it's a different thing to read it and to be initiated, as we all know. How do you find out what's right for you? Imagine you're 19 years old, like you were back then, and don't take your example, you are the exception. And you say, should I become this, or should I go to Armagh, or should I go to Golden Dawn, or what else? How does that person find out his or her right myth?
Yes. How do you find that environment that helps you best flourish? It can be quite challenging, and it's not just something for newbies, but even seasoned people do struggle with that. I mean, after you become a master mason, all of a sudden there's all these other appendant bodies that are open to you. Should you join any? And if so, what one? And it's very difficult to find out what happens behind closed doors. We're very good at concealing a lot of information in these traditions, and there's a fine line between trying to maintain some mystery and conceal the secrets that we're obligated to, whilst at the same time making sure that the candidate understands what they're getting into, because otherwise they're going to join they'll do their first degree and then they'll go, you know what, this actually isn't for me. And then they leave. And unfortunately, you might get some teams that might go, well, maybe we did something wrong. Maybe we've got to change the lodge. But in reality, maybe it just wasn't right for that candidate at that time.
But there was the role of the one who lets the candidate in. I mean, it's not just the candidate who searches. There is also the group who knows what they are and who select their candidates.
So yes, how do you see right. that? I mean, that's the ultimate purpose of our application forms and things like that, having a proposer and having a seconder. These aren't just rules that we fulfill to keep Grand Lodge happy. These are important. Yeah, we should get to know the candidate. Are they suitable right. for our group? Is this group, are they going to be good for us, and are we going to be good for them? You do get some people that they get this feeling that, oh my God, we've lost all of our members. We've got to make sure, what are we going to do for officers in 5 years' time? But gee, we better get people in the door quickly, otherwise we're not going to survive. And it's a terrible attitude, because what ends up happening is you end up bringing people in that under false pretenses. We have to be brave mm-hmm. enough to be able to say, you know what, you deserve a group that's right for you, and it isn't our group, which is hard to say, especially if your group is on the brink of handing in their warrant or something, you know. It is difficult to find your own home. I would say to people to really follow your heart. See what you can find about the culture of the group that you join, and really try to find out about that culture. It's not just the history that you're joining. It's the culture of the group itself that's very important. They could have the best ritual and in the world, but at the end of the day, if the culture of the group is not right for you, it's not right for you.
Absolutely. And I think you agree, but I would really like to stress, and that's not only true for Freemasonry, but I believe also for other groups, that the responsibility lies not only with the candidates or the people who search, but it is also the responsibility of the existing groups to look for the candidates, not just to see who's coming, is he okay or is she okay, but also go out there and look around for people if they could be okay.
Yes, yes, that's right.
I'm not talking about Masonry alone, right? But artists as
yes.
well.
And of course, there was one of the governing rules of the Fraternity of the Rosy Cross in the Pharma, that each person should choose their own successor. And like, there's many ways you could interpret that. But certainly finding somebody that can help the tradition express itself, which is something I don't think we look at enough in Rosicrucianism. We tend to get isolated within our group, as opposed to seeing what is best to allow that tradition to express itself. But that's why we're here, in some ways, is to allow this Rosicrucian tradition to express itself. Instead, we start putting up barriers mm-hmm. to identify ourselves as separate from another group, which is quite unfortunate, I think.
Also by vanity sometimes.
Yes.
So when we, that brings us, in my opinion, right into the question of some very important part of your book, of those legends that came down and gave legitimacy to one or the other group, the foundational legends, you call it in your section 3 of the book, right? So just yes. for our listeners, in the book, Travis talks about the foundational legends of the Armor of Arc, of SRIA, and of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, right? And especially, maybe, but please correct me, especially the foundational legend of the Golden Dawn, which I know all the societies rather well, and I mean, I've been a Freemason for 35 years. I'm very active in there. I know the Golden Dawn very well, etc. But especially that legend seems to me often like, we have to find something to create ourselves, to give ourselves some importance. Like if the content were not important enough, because the content is, in my view, important enough. In a way, same thing is true for craft masonry. When you read Anderson's the whole prequel to the rules. Actually, he sets up the whole story. He invents. I mean, it's clear to all of us, but still, it's like a legend that's there. And why is that necessary? Why do you have to get a letter for some lady in Germany to create a group in London and make it legitimate? What's happening with people that they need that? I'm not saying that overcritically. I'm trying to find out. You know, but.
Yeah. Look, it's a very good question. I think it's something that we tend to overlook today, especially. We're a very different society to when these groups were developed. So we tend to look at things like academic integrity. It's much more important today than it was back then. So we might look at some of the legendary aspects of these societies and look at them through our lens of today and say, well, you know, these people might have been being a bit childish. They were they were stretching the truth a little bit and making things up. And look, certainly there is a case for these legends to help bolster authority. It's certainly much. It does enhance your cause a little bit if you say, well, you know, my tradition's based on something much older, versus if you say, oh, look, I've got a great idea. How about we get together and we do this? So certainly there is that authority that appealing to something ancient or mystical or divine gives you. And I think it is a very important purpose. But there's also that emotional appeal as well that it can create in others. And then, of course, there's how it resonates with the Rosicrucian mythos itself. Now, each of these three traditions that I discuss in the book, SRIA, Amok, and the Golden Dawn, and I'm sure they're not the only Rosicrucian societies. There's just the three that I mentioned, partly because they were all from a very similar period.
Sure.
They all started with a similar idea, like Christian Rosencrucians. They start off with somebody that's quite sincere. They come in contact with somebody from a faraway land who gives them some special knowledge, who gives them the authority to start up a Rosicrucian society in their native land. The only reason I call this section of the book legends is because unlike some of the initiatic narratives that we use in initiatory traditions, these actually do have some element of truth in them. You know, in each of these cases, they really did come in contact with people from a pre-existing tradition. Yes, maybe not in exactly the way that they had described, but certainly they did come in contact with them. As for why they might have embellished it or made it a legend, yes, you can do it for authority. You can do it to help appeal to that Rosicrucian mythos. But also in some cases, and we find this particularly in the case of Amok, to preserve identities. There's some people that would not have wanted to be recognized as being associated. So there's pseudonyms that end up being applied. And if you read it carefully, there are ways that you can identify certain people, which I certainly have in the book. But yes, those people would not have wanted to have been identified at that time. So there's several reasons why you might want to use a legend. But I don't think we should discount the romantic side. There is a reason for that. It's not just childish stories. You know, there is a unity that it helps to create. And you could maybe even start getting into ideas about how that might affect the spiritual aspect of a dimension of a group, such as the egregore as well. You know, these romantic sides do actually play a role.
Definitely. So, I mean, I'm fully with you. For example, I mean, I just was mentioning Reverend Anderson and his long story about masonry, but of course that you can also see that as a like almost a hermetic legend to create that unity that you just mentioned between all those movements, which in the end lead to what we practice here today, right? I think maybe that might be at that time in 1740, 1720 something. The idea of Anderson, 24 actually, it was this year, the 300th anniversary of his book, but isn't, I mean, I don't want to overstress that, but isn't Hermeticism, as I just mentioned it, also often at the basic of those legends? Because Hermeticism always tries to, in my view, to be not precise enough in order to leave a lot of space to your own reflection and development. You know, when I read the Hermetic stories, background stories, and many of them, especially in the Golden Dawn, of course, but also in Almorc, you have Hermeticism at the background. And when you read the Corpus Hermeticum and its dialogues there, they are, in my view, voluntarily imprecise in order to leave space for the individual to fill those gaps with your own thought, and not individually own thought, but to find out yourself, basically. I would put it like that. And I sometimes get the impression that those legends are all a bit thought in those terms. Or do you see that differently?
Yes, absolutely. I suppose it comes back to the human experience a little bit. You know, we are all do have a bit of a similar makeup in some ways, but that part of us that we're trying to discover is hidden away from us. It's not hidden away because it's we're hiding it. It's hidden away because it's concealed by its very nature. But curiously, just like the secrets in many of our traditions, we think we're keeping the meaning from people by not telling them. But really, it's because their meaning is concealed. It's something we need to reflect upon and chew on and contemplate. And you're right. Like, if you look at the Divine Pymander, it starts off with the protagonist sitting down having a rest, when all of a sudden a great being is thrust upon him, and he has this what really is a mystical experience. Many of these stories are designed in much the same way. We can't give somebody any esoteric knowledge. And anybody that says, you know, join our lodge, we're esoteric and we're going to give you that knowledge, they're pulling your leg. That's not going to happen at all. You can't give somebody that knowledge. The best you can do, though, is try to direct them, put up signposts. And that's what a lot of these stories do. They try to direct people to that within themselves. They're not explicit. But they're not explicit because you sort of can't be explicit, not because you don't want to, but because this is something that needs to be experienced, something that needs to come from within. It's just simply can't be given to somebody. I suppose it comes down to that ineffability of a mystical experience. It's something that is hard to communicate. You know, people like to use analogies like trying to describe a sunrise to somebody that hasn't seen one, or the smell of a rose to somebody that's never smelled one. I mean, these are good analogies because they do impress upon how difficult it is.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's why a lot of these mystery traditions, a lot of these initiatic traditions that we have, we put an awful lot of effort into playing with the scenery and offices and colors and sounds and smells to try and direct candidates towards an experience. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it might be a bit delayed, but sometimes it happens to us as witnesses and officers. You know, we see with traditional societies, often our rituals haven't changed for a long time. Or if they have, they might have only changed in some minor way. We might have seen the same ceremony dozens of times. But at some point we look at it and we go, oh my God, I only just recognized that. I can't believe I didn't see that before. And the ritual hasn't changed. But there's something that's finally sparked within you that you've been able to recognize. And it can be quite multifaceted. You know, there's no one way of looking at this either. There can be multiple aha moments from the same portion of that ritual. I think that's the reason why many of us can see the same ceremony over and over and over again and not get bored. It becomes, there's always something new to find.
Yeah, definitely. I have a follow-up question for that, but after a break, we take our little musical break now, Travis. And, you chose a piece by Debussy as this interval piece of music. Can you tell us what it is and why you chose it?
Yes. I know that you like to have classical music on your show, and Debussy is just my favorite classical composer, so that's one of the reasons. But I also thought it was quite relevant. I have heard that he was a member of the Kabbalistic Order of the Rose Croix. Now, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but he was certainly involved with that milieu of people. But the story behind this track was there was a world fair in Paris, and he came across a Javanese percussive instrument called gamelan. It's like a lot of Aussies, we like to go holidaying in an island next to Java called Bali, and they still play gamelan in Bali a lot. And I'm a bit of a fan of Bali and gamelan as well. So it's an interesting track because you got Debussy, who is obviously a very impressive composer. I'm sure many of us have heard his tracks like Clair de Lune. But he's taken inspiration from the gamelan in this track. So you do get a sort of Eastern feel to this track as well. And I don't know, I find it very interesting. It's it sort of just feels like he's playing us a little bit when he's playing this song. I think it's very beautiful.
So it's Pagodas by Claude Debussy and performed by somebody I really think was one of the best in his, is he's dead already, Claudio Arrau, will perform for us. Thank you.
Well, I do hope you still remembered this Indonesian gamelan music from the beginning and you were able to compare what you just heard with that original, well, inspiration for the piece Pagode by Claude Debussy that you just heard. So Pagode by Claude Debussy, I mentioned the pianist that you were listening to, Claudio Rau. He's unfortunately already and no longer among us, but he was one of the greatest of all time from Argentina. A real gentleman. I had still the pleasure to see him in person and to hear him perform in person. So really great, great man. Right, we are going to return very, very soon now to the interview, to that interesting talk with Travis. Before that, let me still announce you what will be the third piece of music. Well, the piece is a percussion music again, but a contemporary percussion music. It's called Ritual Music. It is composed by percussionist and composer David Skidmore, a new piece. And those of you who are percussionists yourself, professional percussionists maybe, or who have studied in conservatory or at university percussion, you might know that piece because it's become quite famous for exams and for performances in universities. So it's a fascinating piece of music called, in its subtitle, Variations on the Numbers 2 and 4. So there is some hidden meaning behind it, I'm sure. Well, maybe you'll find out, but after the interview. Because before we go and listen to Ritual Music by David Skidmore, this will now be Travis Trinka and Rudolf in the second part of the interview for Pants Overs podcast.
Yeah, just before we listen to that beautiful piece of music, Travis, you mentioned what the influence on ritual is. Sometimes you only discover something for yourself in a ritual or in a myth even after years, and or maybe even what a myth or a ritual tells you might even change over the years. I also made that experience myself. Now, maybe my question comes from the fact that I'm a theater guy, but I would also think that even by the performer, now that's not the right word for ritual, of course, but by the people who perform, yes, they perform a ritual. It's a kind of a play, of course. You play the myth, right? The different way of interpreting it as the performer might also give a myth a different leaning, maybe not meaning, but a different leaning. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Look, there's in some traditions, the certain offices have very distinct roles. You know, sometimes it might require to be a bit, you do have to, as you say, you do have to perform. You're not just repeating the words. Yes, memory and repeating the words and memorizing, that's part of it. But delivery is very important, especially if that's a part of your role. And now thinking of some particular roles where officers are asked to be, to express in certain ways. And sometimes that could be aggressive. No, maybe aggressive is not the right word, but, you know, as a bit of a tempter, for instance. Or sometimes it might, an officer might be asked to represent something like conscience or something beautiful and peaceful. Or sometimes you could think of a conductor. A lot of traditions will have a conductor who's guiding the aspirant or the initiate around. You know, being able to assume that role of office is very important. And it is a bit of a lost skill. There's a lot of, I would say below B grade actors in a lot of initiatic traditions. We have C and D grade actors taking on offices, and that's sort of part of the fun of it. But we should always aspire to assume the role as best we can. And that comes with understanding the role, but also rehearsing and practicing. Right. Some people might find that a bit boring, but it's very important that we do rehearse and take the time to sincerely reflect on what is it that we're actually trying to achieve? What is the role that I'm actually doing? What's my purpose in this ceremony? It's not everybody's purpose to be the protagonist. There's only one protagonist in that ceremony. We have a role. What is that role?
And maybe the protagonist is the candidate anyway.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
You were mentioning earlier, and we go into those three legends in a minute, but before that, you were mentioned several times the hieramic myth for Freemasonry, of course, for those of you out there who listen, who know about it. But all there, of course, history tells us that in the early 18th century, that is when Freemasonry became what it is today in England, it was a completely different myth that was the foundational myth. It was Noah and the Ark, right? Which basically where it became the hieramic myth only in the mid-18th century. So how can such a switch within such an important group of, well, such an important tradition, how can such an important change of myth occur, and what does it cause?
I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that one. I'm actually not familiar with that change and the reasons why. So I can't speak to why they might have moved from one myth to another, other than to suggest, I suppose, that maybe there was a thought that one might be more appealing to that group. But no, I'm not familiar with the history of why that change happened.
I don't think many people would know that answer anyway, because I think it's a kind of a strange story. But I'm not able to answer that either. I just know the fact. But your answer is exactly where I wanted to go, because I think we choose myths because we want to put it on something that's important to us, right? And if we find a better fit, we might also change a myth.
Yes. Look, this idea of changing the myth is a tricky one, because there's some suggestions that get thrown around now, particularly in our world with our academic integrity and everything. Yes, we're a very different sort of society to what we were at the turn of the 20th century when some of these Rosicrucian orders were coming about. And certainly academic integrity is very important, but we shouldn't confuse ourselves with researchers. You know, some of us might be in our personal lives, but generally we talk about things like Masonic research and things like that. But at the end of the day, that's not what we are. That's not our purpose. We're not academics. I've lost my train of thought there, Rudolf.
No, but I think you said something very important there, and that's what I was going for. I think it's the human being. That's why I was talking about the actor or the performer before, right? And now also from the point of view of the recipient, so to speak, I think the combination of emotion and story and intellect and story, that mix of the three is extremely important. And I think you point that out in your book very clearly. And that's why I was going for it's not analyzing academically why this happened. It is actually what did it create in the people who received it, and that's the interesting part.
The story itself should be able to, you know, bridge that gap between the meaning that's being imparted in that allegory and our personal understanding. That's all that action, the symbolism, the language, all of that is to help make that gap between our personal understanding and that message. Try and get it narrower and narrower and narrower until we actually get that message. And there might be multiple layers to that message, but that's the purpose of what we're trying to do, I suppose.
Let's talk a bit about those three main groups that you mentioned in your book as examples, and because you have special relationships with or to them as well, and probably they're also among they are the three most important groups in Rosicrucian groups, not only nowadays but over the centuries, even one could say. Let's start with Amorc. You mentioned before that it was also your start, and in a way it was also mine. I was never I was a member, but not a member who went to the temple there. I lived in France at the time, and so there was the French Amorc was of course very strong in the early 80s, and so I became a member. I received their booklets, their monthly booklets at the time, of course, no internet. And I must say, I learned a lot, and it gave me a lot of impulse to go further. Mm-hmm. And that's just my personal story. I think many who have been or are with Amorc relate to that. I have heard that story quite a lot. And at some point you just find, now I want something else, right? But that's just about it. But tell us about the legend. Tell us briefly about what is the background story to Amorc, and what's the key to Amorc in this context that we are talking about here?
Yeah, well, look, it's a tradition that's been going for quite a long time now. So Amorc was established in 1915 in New York. So it's been going for quite some time, and the Amorc that was then is—it's certainly different today. And there's been changes during that period, where the culture has sort of changed as time has gone on, and not just on a worldwide scale, but also locally in various areas, there's been lots of changes as well. So, what Amorc might mean to one person can be quite different for another person. I was always very fascinated by Amorc, about its beginnings, about how it started off. I was always very taken by the writings of H. Spencer Lewis. I'm certainly not somebody that toes the line of any group that I've ever belonged to. I think it's we should be able to look around and recognize that we're all just people at the end of the day, and that includes officers. Of lodges as well. We're all just people trying our best. But the way Amorc started was quite interesting, because it started off with, I suppose, quite an abrupt story, which was a bit different to some of the others. So when H. Spencer Lewis started Amorc in 1915, he said that he had received authority from a group of Rosicrucians from France in 1909. And he gives this story of how he traveled to France and had this initiatory experience. And he gives it in several locations. The main location where he provides this story was in a article in the Rosicrucian periodical at the time called The American Rosicrucis, in an article called A Pilgrim's Journey to the East. And in that story, he relates how he had journeyed over to France, traveled down to the south to Toulouse, where he had gone on this sort of quest to try and find Rosicrucians. He met various people that were testing him along the way to test his sincerity, make sure he was on the right track. And eventually he was successful. He was initiated by this group of Rosicrucians in Toulouse. They gave him authority to start a Rosicrucian tradition back in America. He travels back to America, maintains some communication with them while establishing Amok in 1915. Now, that's the story he provides, an overview. He does give some extra details in some other sources. So there is some communication he provides to some higher ranking members. And look, some people might think, well, in those, he must give lots of information. But look, it's no less cryptic when you read those messages that he related to those higher ranked members. But he does provide, I suppose, a couple of little threads that you can pull upon to try and assess what was happening and see if you can identify anybody. And that's sort of how I got started on that process, was I recognized a couple of names, and there were some things that were being said that sounded familiar to me from other Rosicrucian traditions that I had been familiar with. And I thought, as I was pulling on those threads, something started to untangle, and I'm like, oh, I'm starting to see an image here. And it turns out that actually, there is some truth to what he was saying. I do sort of give a thorough overview of both the mythical story, the legendary story that he provides, but also what is likely to have actually happened. And he certainly did travel to Toulouse, and he certainly did find a group of Rosicrucians there. And the core elements of what he had to say, really, it turns out to be quite possible. Not really quite possible, as some parts actually have happened. But certainly there are some parts that have become legendary. He has embellished. He has added things on. Now, some people might be a bit cynical and say, well, there we go. He's just made it up. But no, this is actually quite common in the Rosicrucian tradition, and we've spoken about the purpose of some of these stories. I quite enjoy that there was an existing Rosicrucian tradition in Toulouse, but it was very different. So it does make a lot of sense. At the time when A. Spencer Lewis announced Amok, there were leaders of other Rosicrucian organizations, and they were familiar with Rosicrucianism in their group. And they're saying, look, we're in a Rosicrucian organization. We have no idea who this guy is. He doesn't belong to us. He's not a leader of any of our groups. And in fact, the Rosicrucianism he's talking about is very different to what we do. So I don't even know what he's talking about. And it makes a lot of sense, because the information that he had to go on, that led him on his search, and the people that he came in contact with were vastly different to those other traditions. In fact, when he went over to France, he was only 25 years old at the time. But he didn't have much information. Basically, what happened was that he was working for a periodical in New York, writing about various things on like hypnotism. And he was working with this group called the New York Society for Psychical Research. And this old lady came in, and they used to work together. And at this point, they were having a discussion about reincarnation. And this elderly lady, who was quite experienced, she was a member of the Esoteric School of Theosophy. She had started talking to him about one of his past lives and had mentioned the Rosicrucians of Egypt. And in some of A. Spencer Lewis's private writings, he says, well, I still remember from when this dear old lady had told me about these Rosicrucians of Egypt, it left an impression on my mind. I'm sort of paraphrasing him here. And he said, despite the fact that every time I went to the library to search out anything about these Rosicrucians, everything I found was about them being in Germany. Yet this lady maintained that she only ever referred to them as the Rosicrucians of Egypt, which I found really odd. And so already we're starting to see that whatever this Rosicrucian tradition was that he was coming in contact with, it was quite different to what we might see in other traditions. Mm-hmm. And yes, the Rosicrucians of Toulouse were very different to other traditions. We often like to think of French Rosicrucians. We often think of what was happening up north in Paris. We tend to think about
Pilatin and Papus and those people. Yeah,
that's
yeah,
right. Yeah, that's yeah. right. Of what was happening in the Martinist order and the Kabbalistic order of the Rose Croix. Paladin himself was a Toulousian, sort of gives some hints to what their personalities were like in Toulouse, because when he started the Kabbalistic order of the Rose Croix with De Guaita, there was shortly after a bit of a schism. They had a bit of a butted heads about the way things should progress. And it's not surprising because it had different ways of doing things. The Rosicrucians of Toulouse were much different. They weren't so flamboyant. They weren't into all sorts of magical practices or anything. They were really just a circle of intimate friends that were working together in local community groups. They were nearly all of the noble class. Involved in lots of community groups and discussing esoteric and Rosicrucian topics privately. So there wasn't so much like charters and warrants and lodges and all these sorts of things. Things were much more simple. I suppose you could compare it to, when people talk about the idea of Martinist circles around the time of Louis Claude de Saint-Martin. It's a very sort of similar idea. It was an intimate circle of people rather than groups of lodges and things like that.
Yeah.
So as for why he added on these extra details, look, there's various reasons why he's added on these extra details. Part of it is for this idea of authority and appealing to something older than oneself. But there is certainly also a need to keep private. There were people, I mentioned the Rosicrucians of Toulouse were often of the noble class, and they held positions as politicians, as mayors and things like this. So naturally, they wouldn't want to be identified. And at the end of the day, what H. Spencer Lewis was developing was, even though it may have been started in Toulouse, it was vastly different. He added on lots of extra stuff. There are still some things in Amok that are being maintained. The first degree Tepl initiation does have links to that Toulouse tradition. And there are a couple of other ceremonies that have links to it as well. I'm still not really sure how much many of the officers of Amok are familiar with this. To many people I speak to in Amok, this story of H. Spencer Lewis's initiation is usually just seen as either 100% true and exactly as he said is 100% true, or they look at it and say, well, this is a symbolic story. It was something that was a psychic initiation. It didn't actually happen. Whereas the truth is actually somewhere in the middle. It was a little bit of both.
Talking about the myth, let's move on to the Golden Dawn in that trilogy you mentioned, and go come back to Sria at the end, because I think that's maybe the least known also among our listeners here. Golden Dawn, of course, is probably even more known than Amok, and we mentioned that legend about the letter from Germany before. You want to expand a little bit on that without going into all the detail, but talking about inspiration from the outside, maybe that's an important metric.
It's sort of the ultimate.
To use a pun here.
It's sort of the ultimate Rosicrucian story in some ways, isn't it? Like coming in contact with somebody wise from a faraway land. Look, of the three traditions that I mentioned, I have to say Golden Dawn is the one that I do not have a lot of practical, intimate experience with. I had to rely on others for this. I do have a bit of a passion for the writings of Westcott, sort of my in, I suppose, with the Golden Dawn. So a lot of what I provide about in the Golden Dawn section, I suppose, is not so much new information. Obviously, the Amok section contains a lot of new research. This doesn't really so much contain new research. It's existing research that others have done. But I suppose it's just a different way of looking at it, because when the Golden Dawn schism started to happen, a lot of people tend to focus on the personalities that were involved in that. But we forget about what was actually happening behind the scenes. There was this undermining of the authority of the underlying legend. And once that story started to be undermined, Westcott's just made this whole story up and it's all just a lot of rubbish. Once that started happening, things started to fall apart. That unity was broken. And that's what I really wanted to get across in this chapter, was that It's one of the purposes of having these foundational legends. They serve to unite us to a common bond and ideal. And when that is undermined, it can cause some problems there as well. That's not to say that we shouldn't be able to analyze our traditions. I think we absolutely should be able to. But certainly in this case, there was a lot of emphasis on it being authentic. And then when that started to unravel, it unraveled very quickly and caused a lot of issues, and eventually it would break up.
Maybe it wasn't strong enough as an egregore binding story in the beginning. Maybe that's also a possibility. I think, okay. Again, that's I am saying that, and I have no proof for that, but that's also my interpretation in the Noah legend moving into the Hiramic legend, because the Noah story is not strong enough as such.
Yep.
As a creationist legend, and Solomon's temple and Hiram and everything like that is much, much more present even in the scriptures, right?
That's
and therefore
right.
probably much, much more important. Okay, well then, but if I'm not wrong, the Golden Dawn came a bit out of Ezra-A, because at some point, of course, Ezra-A, there were no women in there because it was purely Masonic background. You had to have a purely Masonic background, or still have to have Masonic background for that. And so they opened up to other faiths. They opened up to female membership. But SRIA was there before, right? So what is the founding legend behind SRIA then?
Well, the SRIA one is an interesting one, because it's the only one of the ones that I present that the founding legend actually started after the founding of the organization itself. SRIA was started in 1867 by Little. But the legend that I discuss is one that's very little known to members of the SRIA. It was quite deliberately forgotten by the society, because it was found out that it was not truthful. So it really came about 30 years after the founding of the SRIA, and it was by Westcott. And this was probably one of his first attempts. He was writing this legend alongside his Golden Dawn legend. And I give some reasons as to why he probably created this legend in the book, which those reasons I give in the book that I propose. And I've been fortunate enough to have this backed up by some photographs of archival evidence as well, was that he had found out that some of the stuff that Little had said about how he had been initiated by this Rosicrucian Society in Scotland, the process that he went through and the events that he went through weren't really up to scratch. What he had said wasn't quite accurate. So I think, I reckon Westcott was probably feeling, well, we're going to need to reinvent ourselves a little bit. So he's decided to create a bit of a legendary foundation. And he put a lot of emphasis in this tradition on a fellow called Mackenzie. And fortunately, Mackenzie had just passed away, so he was in no position to deny what Westcott was saying. So Westcott develops this elaborate backstory about how the SRIA came to be. And really, this existing Rosicrucian tradition in Scotland that Little had been initiated into really becomes a bit of a side story to Westcott's story. But Westcott brings this new story to the forefront about Mackenzie's travels to Germany and where he had been initiated into a Rosicrucian tradition there. So he places this at the forefront and says, well, this is the spiritual lineage of our Rosicrucian tradition. But again, like the other Rosicrucian tradition legends, this is a legend because it does have some real seeds of truth to it. There's some parts that really were true, but there are also some parts that have been added on over time as well.
Right.
But I think it was deliberately forgotten by the SRIA. Mm. There's been a few attempts at writing a history with the SRIA, and this one, I think, was sort of forgotten about because it was sort of untangled and deemed to be untrue, and it was there was a return to what Little had said. But what Little had said was also untrue, and I don't think many people realise that today. And so they might be taken aback to read some of the stuff in the book. But yes, this to date, I don't think there is any accurate history of the SRIA. There's lots of histories, but and they all contain little bits of truth, but they all contain a little bit of untruth as well.
I think that's part of many meals of smaller, lesser-known groups, because somehow you need to justify your existence. Somehow you want to attract people. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why you do that. But in the end, it comes down to the individual, in my point of view, what he or she makes out of it. And it's those individual looks on the myth that make up the egregore of a group, right?
Yeah, I think you recognize a Rosicrucian tradition by their fruits. That's really, I mean, we shouldn't get bogged down in things like lineages and things in Rosicrucianism in terms of any lineal descent or past laying on of hands or passing of lineal descent. We really should start looking at Rosicrucianism as being recognized by their fruits. And to me, that's what makes Rosicrucian group so special. Like, Rosicrucianism is that ultimate, the real Rosicrucians were the friends we made along the way. You get together to discuss Rosicrucianism and you create that which you are seeking for. And if we look at the fruits of these Rosicrucian pioneers, like Westcott, for instance, we see the tremendous work that they actually achieved. What they achieved was just remarkable. And I, personally, I think that the reason why they achieved that work was because they were a participant in the Rosicrucian tradition itself. There was something that was working through them to help bring that out. It wasn't just their own identity that was bringing that out. There was something else happening behind the scenes as well. That's my personal opinion anyway.
Yeah, very good point. Well, Travis, we are slowly coming towards the end of our talk, but maybe you have some other plans about books or what else that you would like our listeners to know about. Is there something coming up that you would like to tell us?
I always try to, I've always got lots of little talks and things that are coming up, and I tend to advertise them on the Instagram page. So it's travis.trinker.author. So if you're ever interested in what I'm getting up to, I usually put things on there. I think there'll be an article going up on the Pantsuffers blog soon these lines about stories that we use in the Rosicrucian tradition. I think there's an Italian translation in the works as well of The Temple and the Bolt. And yes, there's a second book being worked on as well. I can't really say too much about it at this stage other than to say that it will be Rosicrucian in focus.
Okay, so we have our eyes and ears open. And yes, about that blog page on the Pantsuffers, of course, that's important though. And also maybe people who got interested and haven't yet seen the great series that Sam Robinson on the Pantsuffers site created 2 or 3 years ago about the different Rosicrucian groups and their Rosicrucian content, actually. And that's also something that people who are interested and got interested by this talk should go and have a look at. Do you have any final word for our listeners?
No, thank you for listening. I hope that you enjoyed. If you do get a copy of The Temple and the Vault and you have any queries, Absolutely. Feel free to reach out.
Great. And I have a final word, but it's not from me. It's not from you either, but it's in your book. And I find it perfect. It's by J.K. Rowling, right?
That's correct.
And you put it at the end and said, "Tell me one last thing," said Harry, being Harry Potter. "Is this real or has this been happening inside my head?" And Dumbledore's appearance tells him, "Of course it's happening inside your head, Harry. But why on earth should that mean that it is not real?" Okay, thanks.
Beautiful.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ritual Music, Variations on the Numbers 2 and 4 by composer David Skidmore. Quite an exciting piece, I find, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Well, that was episode 3 of the Pansovers podcast. I welcomed Travis Trinka, my guest here today, and we were speaking about ritual, about stories of initiation, and how certain initiation types also came into being in our Western culture. I hope you enjoyed that. And well, I'll hope you'll enjoy next time, because next time, that should be in 2 weeks. What I've planned to bring to you next time in episode 4 will be Chuck Dunning, and he has recently released a new book. And I know that that book is on its way to me. He has told me, he has sent it off. So if the mail services from the US to Europe are doing their job as they should, I should get that book in time to still prepare for that interview in 2 weeks' time with Chuck. If not, well, you'll have some other guest in 2 weeks on the show, and in that case, I will bring Chuck in the following episode, early December. What you might also not want to miss is next week's show on the Thoth Hermes podcast. So next Sunday is the third Sunday in the month, and that's the week when I produce a new episode of that wonderful series on science and the occult together with my co-host Karin. So do not miss that either on the Thoth Hermes podcast. My guest, or our guest, Karin's, and my guest will be Eric Wargo. And, well, that's it for today. Hope to hear you soon. See you soon on one of those two podcasts. And for the time, let me say, take care. Stay tuned. Hear you soon.